You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
Well, it's good to be in church again today. We're going to be in Esther, so you can go ahead and turn there to Esther and also put a bookmark or something in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and God willing, if things go according to plan, we will end up there at some point throughout the sermon. It's a pleasure to have my family with me this morning. So I've got my grandpa on my mom's side, Pastor David Pringle. My mom and dad are with me. I've got my brother Jeremy and his wife Victoria, my brother Jacob, got my brother Jonathan and his wife Courtney, and then we've got Miss Bethany. She's a friend of my sister's who's here. And then we've got a bunch of kids sitting in there, and I'm not going to go through all of their names. But I owe a lot to these people, specifically to my grandpa and then my mom and dad. So my grandpa, actually, my Bible that I use up here when I'm preaching, the inscription at the beginning is to Joshua Bartels from Pop-Up Pringle on March 11th of 2004. So each week when I'm preaching, I'm using a Bible that he gave me as a teenager, and he's always been an encouragement to me. He pastored for a long time. He retired, moved to Springfield, and then he regularly fills the pulpit while pastors are out on vacation. So he usually does what I'm doing today, filling the pulpit for our pastor while he's on vacation. And then my father, it was really neat to hear Brother Scott read this morning this passage in Luke, because I remember a time as a teenager, I was probably 17 or 18, and of course I grew up in church. My dad was a pastor for a while, and then he was running a printing ministry at a church in Oklahoma. And the pastor was up preaching one day, and he talked about that passage. And he wasn't preaching that passage. He just made a reference to it offhand and said, you know what? People talk about how the people in the temple were astonished that Jesus was, you know, at all the answers Jesus was giving them. And he says, no, they weren't astonished at that. They were astonished at the questions he was asking. And if you paid attention this morning in the reading, it specifically says they were astonished at the answers that he was giving. It does mention his questions. But I think the preacher just mixed up his words, got him, you know, a little bit discombobulated and said the wrong thing. But for some reason he camped on it, made a point about it. And later, I think it was that next day, my dad pointed out to me, we were in the print shop together, and he's like, you know, Josh, yesterday the preacher said this, and that's not what the Bible says. And he opened the Bible and he showed, here's what the Bible had said. And it was so obvious. And at that moment, I mean, I heard this all my life. People had preached and taught about the authority of the Word of God. But for me, that was the moment when it clicked that our authority in the church is not the man in the pulpit. Our authority in the church is the Word of God. And it was so it's things like that that my dad and my grandpa have invested in me to shape me to be the kind of man I am today. Then I've got my mom here, and my mom is the reason I'm alive and likable at all. And then, of course, I got my brothers, and if I'm dislikable, I blame them entirely. Yeah. So I'm glad to have them today. We're glad to have all of you that are guests this morning with us. We really appreciate each of you being here with us this morning. All right, well, we're going to be in the book of Esther. I'm not going to start by reading the entire text because we're going to preach the entire book of Esther, God willing, go through the whole story. But if you're there in chapter 1, that's where we are going to be beginning, and I will hopefully at a couple of points throughout the way be pointing to specific texts and kind of allow you to follow along that way. But we're just going to work our way through it. So just hang on for the ride. Let's pray, though, before we begin. Father in heaven, we come this morning before you, and we are people who need to hear from you. Lord, we are people who has been called out by your word and who are being shaped by it. And this morning, that is why we are here. So I pray that, Father, your spirit would use your word now in our lives to shape in us the image of Christ, that people would be able to see you in us, that you would be glorified through our lives because of this. In Jesus' name, amen. As we begin to learn about God, whether that's as a young child growing up in a Christian home, whether that's when we first come to the faith, we begin, of course, to have some very basic questions about God. And, of course, as a kid, first question, what does he look like? Like, who is he? What are we thinking of? Because this doesn't sound like a man, right? He apparently made the world, so he's bigger than the world. What does he look like? Is he just a massive version of us? Thoughts of images start to flood into our head, and we try to figure it out, right? But eventually we learn that God is a spirit. And those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. He does not have a physical form and a physical likeness that we can make into an idol. Instead, he has made us in his image. And then when we learn about Jesus, the second person of the Trinity, of the Godhead, we begin to learn, okay, God looks actually, in one sense, like you and me, because God became a man and he took on a human body and a human, he took on humanity. And so he is fully human. So while he is in that form, in the form of God as Jesus Christ, he looks not altogether too different than you and I. I mean, he's different, a unique person, but that person is going to look no more unique than the other people that we see here on earth. So in one sense, then he's similar. But still, the question becomes, what does God look like? And we start to put that out of our heads because we realize we cannot make an image of God, and that is where we begin to move into the realm of idolatry. But then, as we continue to live trying to obey God and live for him and serve him and please him with our lives, there are times when things get difficult and hard, and we begin to want to see God. We want to see some tangible proof that God cares about us, that God is working in our lives, that God is present. We want to see it. We want to be able to touch it and to feel it and to know it. That's what we want when those times get hard. And this book of Esther, the story of Esther, is all about that search. It's all about that question, where is God? How do we see God? That's what the book of Esther is about. So let's dive in to the story. And the story, while it's about Esther, begins with a king. Begins with a king whose kingdom is going well, King Ahasuerus. And this term is a title for the king, the great king. So this could have either been Xerxes or Darius, and we're not going to get into trying to figure out which one that is today. But the great king of Persia, of this Persian Empire, throws a party, a big year-long, half a year-long party. So it's 180 days, half of the length of the Jewish calendar, and he throws a party for his entire kingdom in order to highlight the glory of the empire, the wealth of the kingdom, and then the generosity of the king. That I am a good king and I am going to do good to my subjects. And so he throws this massive party. It goes on for half a year. And then to cap it all off, at the end of this big party, he throws another big party in Shushan the palace. And this is where all of the princes of these different provinces of his kingdom have come together. It's where all the ambassadors from those provinces are. It's where all of the rulers and the princes of Persia are gathered. And from the greatest person in the empire down to the servants, they are all given the opportunity to be a part of this party. So this is huge. This is where no one's working. Everyone's able to do what they want. In fact, there was a regulation that people could only drink and party when the king was drinking and partying. And now he says, listen, you don't have to wait for me to take a drink for you to be able to take a drink. Anyone can drink whenever they want to. He's giving them freedom to do what they want. So this is a big week-long party here in Shushan the palace with the intent of, I want you as my subjects to experience the glory of my kingdom. And then as you experience it and receive of my generosity, you are going to go back into your provinces just utterly astounded at the empire that you get to be a part of. And if you're someone who loves the empire that you're a part of, you are going to be a good ruler, someone who really buys into it, right? And so one of the things he decides to do to cap this off is he sends 7 of his attendants to go to the queen, because the queen was hosting a special party for the women in another part of the palace. He says, I want to bring her out here to show her off to the people of the nations. Now, some have said that this is like a lewd showing, that he wants, it's a sensual thing that he's trying to show her off. But that is not what he is trying to do here, because the one garb that he is having her, he points out, and I think it's in verse number 11, maybe of chapter 1. Yes, verse 11, when he says that they're supposed to bring her out, that she's supposed to bring what? The crown royal. This is the symbol of her position in the kingdom. She is going to be wearing her royal garments, and she is going to come out before these people, and they are going to see now not only the glory of the empire, but now the beauty of the empire, because the mother of Persia is now going to walk out before them and be there beside her king, and they are going to be in awe at this and then go back to their provinces just overwhelmed at the greatness of the Persian Empire. A few moments later, in come the attendants, and there's no Queen Vashti. The queen is not there. And the king inquires, what's going on? She won't come. She said, no. No, I mean, like, so she's coming later? Like, what? No, no, she just refused. She is not coming over to your throne. Well, now the intent has been to show people the glory of the kingdom, and now they are seeing an example of the disrespect and rebellion of the queen. The king is furious. I don't know if it was after the party was over or what, but he gathers together his advisors and says, what are we going to do about this? And they say, listen, king, if we let all of these people go back to their different provinces and talk about what they have seen here, what are they going to talk about? They're not going to talk about all the glory of the empire. They're going to talk about how there's friction within the empire and there's rebellion. And so we have to deal with this. So let's take your signet ring. Let's stamp an edict that says that basically all women are supposed to honor their husbands. And because of this, we are going to depose Vashti from being queen. So we take the royal crown off of her head. She's not allowed to be queen anymore. We send her into the king's harem with the rest of the concubines. And we are going to find a new queen some other time, but we have to get this under control. So that's what they do. They send out this edict. Everything goes well. The king is appeased. Party's over. Back to business as usual. After, though, a little bit of business as usual, the king decides it's time to find a queen. And here's how they were going to do that. They were going to gather together all the young, beautiful virgins from throughout the empire. Now, from all of the, it says that it's coming from all of the different provinces. Now, we might, like in our day, that sounds barbaric maybe to gather them up. But in their day, there's the days of arranged marriages. For your daughter to marry into or even be a part of the king's harem would be an incredible advantage to your family. Right? So the king is not going by force and rounding up little girls and taking them into the palace. No, families are volunteering and sending their daughters to candidate to be queen. Because imagine what would happen if one of the people from our province shows up at the king's side. We now have real advocacy. We really have an advantage in this empire. That's what they want. And so they're gathering up all these young virgins, and they would spend a year preparing to be with the king. And they would do everything that they could to both make them beautiful on the outside and to make them fit to be queen. Because if she's chosen, she's going to need to know how to conduct herself in the court of the king. She's got to know the policies, the practices, the manners, the etiquette that she needs to use while she's in the royal palace. And so they would spend this year, and then one by one, night by night, these girls would go and spend a night with the king. And then the girl who the king wanted the most, who he was most impressed with, he would take her to be his queen and set her up now as the new mother of Persia and put that royal crown on her head. And that's where, this is where we are introduced for the first time to one of the heroes of our story. So look in chapter 2 and let's see, verse number 5. Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. So here's Mordecai, this man who's from Israel, one of the captives. And he's got a cousin named Hadassah, which her pagan name, her Persian name, it was Esther. And she had neither father nor daughter. Her parents had died, so she's an orphan girl that Mordecai takes in as his own daughter. And she is selected to be in this contest to be the next queen of the empire. She is a beautiful young lady, and the king takes her and puts her in the custody of Haggai. Haggai was the man who was in charge of all of these girls to get them ready and ready to go. Now, she makes a big impression on Haggai. He thinks, I really like this girl. And so I'm going to give her the best of the maids. Because they'd be given apparently 7 maids, each of these girls. I mean, so we got a lot of ladies in this big palace getting prepared to get ready. So they've got 7 maids just to help her prepare. And he gives her the best maids and gives her the best place in the entire preparation house. So she's going to stay here for a year and be prepared to go into the king. Now, Mordecai told her something because she was a Jew. So she followed the Jewish practices, the Jewish laws. He tells her, I want you to hide your Jewishness. Now this, the Bible doesn't tell us why he says to hide her Jewishness, but he does. And this is, in fact, if you think of other stories of people going into captivity, like Daniel, this is the opposite of Daniel's tactic. So Daniel goes in, and they say, "You're going to eat the king's meat." He says, "No, I'm not. I'm Jew. Sorry. Can I eat pulse instead?" He stands up. He makes his Jewishness, he puts his Jewishness straight out front and center. With Esther, Mordecai tells her, "Hide it." And we're not told why. So she hides her personage. She stops following the dietary restrictions that are there as a result of her being a Jew. She doesn't follow any of the other practices that would out her as being a Jew. And instead, she conducts herself just like one of the ladies of the empire. And so things continue to go forward. A year later, Esther now has her night with the king. And she only takes what Haggai recommends. They can take whatever they want into the king. She takes recommendations from Haggai. She goes in, she spends the night with the king, and the king is so blown away that he says, "Okay, Esther is the queen." And so they have another party. There's lots of parties in the book of Esther. They have another party, and they bring everyone together, and they put the royal crown on her head, and now the kingdom is complete. We have Esther sitting on in the position of the mother of Persia. She is now the new beauty of the empire. Now, for Mordecai, this is perfect. Because, see, Mordecai says that he stayed in the king's gate and he was a Jew in Shushan the palace. The indication is that Mordecai is the one who represents the Jewish people before the king. So he's the one who is the ambassador or the envoy from the Jews to the king. He's the one representing their interests. And now, the wish of every man of every kingdom that had sent girls to the king to possibly be the new queen is now fulfilled for Mordecai. Mordecai has the option for this beautiful trifecta of him and Esther and the great king, that together we are going to be a powerhouse for our people. And immediately after she becomes queen, the story gives us an insight into what that would look like. So Mordecai is in the gate of the city, and there are a couple of doorkeepers of the gate who would stand there and guard, and they are mad at the great king for some reason. It doesn't say what their beef is with him, but they've got a problem, and they begin conspiring to kill him. And so they have this plan, and they're figuring it out, and Mordecai overhears this whole thing. And so he goes in to Esther and says, "Esther, these guys are conspiring." Esther takes that to the king and says, "Hey, there's a conspiracy to kill you." The king sends an investigation. They investigate. They discover that, sure enough, it's true. Mordecai was right, and these guys are trying to kill me. Those guys get killed. The king is saved. That's an example of exactly how this thing was supposed to be working. It's great. Now we're waiting for the commendation to come down to Mordecai for being such a crucial part of the king's safety. And so here comes the promotion. And after these things, in chapter 3, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman? Haman walks into our story. A different character. Mordecai is not promoted. A different guy is. And this guy's name is Haman. And he is the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. And the king advanced him and set his seat above all princes that were with him. So this man is not only promoted, he's promoted kind of second in rank to the king. And it seems like he might even be the guy who is in charge of the king's army. So he's got a lot of authority and a lot of power in the empire. And this man, he thought he was the top dog. Like, he was excited about his position in the empire. Things were going well for his political career. And when he was so big in the kingdom that as he would walk through the king's gate, walk into the king's court to take care of business, everyone there would bow to him because he is the man at the top of the food chain here. We are all going to bow down and do obeisance to him. And he walks through enjoying all of this except for one guy. There was one guy in there who would not bow to him, and that guy's name was Mordecai. Mordecai, for some reason, and the Bible does not tell us exactly why. We're going to see here in just a minute what it does say. But for some reason, Mordecai decides that he is not going to bow to this Haman. Now, the king's servants know that you're supposed to bow to this Haman. You are supposed to give him this kind of respect and this kind of honor. But Mordecai is not. So they ask him, "What's going on?" And he says, "I'm a Jew." Puts that straight out there. That's his reasoning. Now, there is nothing we know of in Jewish commandments that say that you cannot bow down to another person. It'd be one thing to worship them. Bow down in honor, that's not some kind of command that's not something that's prohibited in Jewish law. So maybe, though, it has to do with their names, because if you remember Mordecai, he was the son of Kish. He's an ancestor of Kish. Kish was the father of King Saul, the first king of Israel. Haman, as chapter 3, verse number 1 says, is an Agagite. If you remember the story of Saul and Agag, Saul was supposed to kill King Agag. Agag was an Amalekite and was supposed to be destroyed entirely, and all of the spoil, all of the herds and flocks that Agag has, everything was supposed to be gone. Saul instead disobeys the words of the prophet, and he goes and takes Agag captive and keeps him alive and keeps a lot of the best of the herds alive. And he gets in big trouble for that. So maybe it's that he sees that since this guy's an Agagite, there's some kind of, you know, reason I shouldn't bow. But whatever the reason is, he decides he's not going to bow. And Haman hates this terribly. And once he discovers that the reason that Mordecai's given for not bowing to me is because I'm a Jew, he goes straight to 11. I'm going to kill all the Jewish people. We're going to do a genocide. If it's because of the Jews, then not one Jew would ever bow to me. And we're going to take all of the Jewish people down. They're disobeying the laws of the king. We can't have that. And so he decides that he is going to try to kill all of the Jewish people. But this is a big ask. I mean, he's going to go before the king and he's going to say to the king, hey, king, there's an entire ethnic group of people here who we're just going to wipe off the face of the map. How about we do that? Right? Like, that's a big ask. And so, in order to make sure that this works for him, that everything goes well, he decides that he's going to cast lots to discover when is the best time to do it. Now, lots, there were different ways that they were cast, but they're something like dice. And they would be rolled to see, and if they hit the winning combination, then that would be a sign from the universe that we need to make a move here in this direction. Today, conditions are favorable. And so day after day after day, he is rolling the dice to see whether or not today is the day. And he rolls again, not today. Rolls again, still not today. Rolls again, and this happens again and again and again and again for almost an entire year. So imagine this for Haman. Day after day, he is in the morning, roll the dice. Not today. Walk past Mordecai. Mordecai doesn't bow. Duh, I hate that guy. Go again, roll the dice. Mordecai doesn't bow. Ugh. Finally, almost a year later, the dice fall favorably. Finally, he feels like he can take this before the king, and it goes swimmingly well. Not a hiccup at all. The king's like, yeah, great, wonderful. He says, listen, I'll even pay. Haman says, I'll pay you, king. And he says, great, wonderful. Just let's go. Don't even worry about the money yet. Kill these people. If they're gonna fight against me and against my kingdom, let's be done with them. And that sends the Jewish people and the rest of the empire into panic because, wait a second, there's an entire race of people that are just going to be wiped away? What's going on? Like, are we next? This seems entirely irrational to the people there in Shushan, and they're put into disarray. Well, Mordecai discovers this, and I don't know, but I kind of reckon that maybe Mordecai realizes that this is a little bit of his fault, that, right, he hasn't been bowing, and now his entire race of people are in danger from the very man who he has not been bowing to. And so he rends his clothes. This is a sign in the Bible and in the old times when they don't have many clothes. This is, you know, he wouldn't have had many changes. He rips it. It's a sign of desperate mourning and sadness. And because he's ripped his clothes and he's mourning, he cannot come into the king's gate anymore. He has to stay outside. And Esther discovers this. And Esther, absolutely oblivious to what's happening in the with the king and with Haman, sends to ask, what's going on, Mordecai? She first sends him a set of clothes. He doesn't take the set of clothes. Then she sends a messenger to say, what's going on? He sends a copy of the edict back to her and says, Esther, this is exactly the kind of thing that I hoped you would be queen for. Because now we have an opportunity to get the king's ear to save our people. Esther says, whoa, 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 whoa. That my life is at stake here. Now, her life was at stake in several ways. First, she has not told the king that she's a Jew. And the king has just issued a decree to destroy all Jews. It kind of seems like maybe the king hates Jews. And if I tell him that I'm a Jew, well, this might be the end game for me. Two, I've never told him I'm a Jew. I've just straight up not told him anything about my family background. And that might be a problem for him, too. Also, when I go into the king. The thing is this is not like a typical husband and wife. You're hanging out all the time. This is king and queen. He might never see her. And in this case, he hasn't seen her for 30 days. She hasn't been summoned in to come and see him at all. He hasn't seemed to be giving a thought to her. And now, if she just walks in, unattended, to the king's court, without being called, she is under threat of death. Because here's their custom. You walk into the king's court, and you're not invited, unless the king issues the golden scepter to you and holds it out and lets you touch it, then Secret Service carries you off and you never come back. That's how it works in the king's court. And so, she says, if I go in there, it doesn't matter that I'm the queen. They don't care. They just a few years ago deposed a queen. Like, they don't mind getting rid of queens. The question is the king going to want to see me? And Mordecai sends back to her and says, listen, you're going to die anyway. It doesn't matter. And our people are going to be saved. But it could be that this is why you are here. That this setup is exactly why you have been allowed to be queen. So she says, all right, I'll go. And if I die, I die. But I want you to fast for 3 days with me. You and all of the Jews in Shushan fast. And me and my ladies, my maids will fast. And then I'll go in. And so here comes the day. The day that Queen Esther might die. And she gets up in the morning. She gets ready. She gets dressed in the royal robes. And she comes before the king into the king's court. And she walks in. And I'm sure her eyes noticed the attendants of the king that had their eyes on her. Because they know she hasn't been summoned. What's she doing here? Maybe she's here to, on a mission to kill the king for her province or something. They don't care who she is. Their only concern is the safety of the king. And so they watch her. And then she turns to the king. And she's watching him and waiting for that moment when his eyes lock onto her and begin to make the decision and begin to calculate. And so are the attendants. The attendants' eyes are going back and forth between Esther and the king and Esther and the king. Has he noticed her yet? Has he not? We've got to stop her if she gets too close. They're focusing. They're tense. Maybe the hands are on the sword. They're ready to go. Esther is holding her breath, hoping that just maybe the king will, get this over with quickly. And she walks closer and closer. And finally, the king's eyes see Esther. And then all eyes in the room go straight to the king's scepter. What's going to happen? And up it goes. She finally takes a breath, approaches the king, touches the scepter, and this is better than could be imagined. He says, listen, queen, it's so good to see you. What do you want? In fact, I'll give you anything up to half of my kingdom. So what he's saying is, like, I'll give you as much as I possibly can without actually letting you be king. Like, it's yours. I'm here for you. What do you need? And she says, actually, could I tell you that over dinner? And I want it just to be you and me and this guy named Haman. Done. I'm in. Call Haman. He calls Haman. They go off to a banquet. Now, Haman, he's over in some, wing of the palace. He's taking care of business, issuing commands to the troops out in the fields, shuffling paperwork. I don't know what he's doing. But then here comes a royal envoy to say, hey, Haman. You're summoned by the king immediately. You got to go. At first, maybe there was a little bit of worry in his eyes, like, what's going on? What's the rush? Queen Esther has asked for you. Queen Esther has asked for me. I mean, he's trying to climb the ladder. He's pretty high in the kingdom now, and now even the queen wants to be with him. Oh, it's just a banquet? Just for you and the king. Well, this is looking pretty good for me. Yes, I will come. Of course, I will accept this commanded invitation. And so then he walks, goes and follows the envoy to the banquet and enjoys a beautiful banquet with the king and the queen and himself. And he is just overjoyed about this. He is absolutely ecstatic. And he leaves that night and just thinking about all of the things that have come together in his life. He is almost second in command to the king. He is in charge of the armies. He has so much power and authority. He has a wonderful home. And in the middle of him thinking about his own greatness, he walks by Mordecai, and as all the people are bowing, there's still this one man that stands, and it just is the burr under his saddle. He cannot stand us. Suddenly the mood is gone. Like, it just crashed it. This is like those moments where you're just having a great time and a really intense, serious conversation with your wife and, wow, we're really communing here. And then suddenly there's a kid that, throws up and the whole thing is just gone, right? You've got to go and take care of business. Like that's what's happening for him. He was in this moment that was just wonderful. Now it's shattered. So he gets home, he gathers his family, all of his servants, all of his kids, all of his attendants. Hey, everyone, listen, I just want to give a speech real quick. Look at how great this is. Look at how many of you there are here with me. Look at the extent of our wealth. Look at the power that I wield in the kingdom. Look at all these things that have so fortunately happened to me. And on top of all of this, today actually, I had a banquet with the king and the queen. And here's what happened at the end of the banquet. You won't believe this. The king asked her what she wanted because he was bringing her there for a request, to let her give him a request. And she said that she actually would love to hold off and do this banquet again and ask tomorrow. She promised that she would tell him what she wanted tomorrow, but she wants me to be there. I am supposed to be with them. Even the extent of my glory knows no bounds, except for one man. That Mordecai, that Jew, oh, I hate him. Oh, the family says, Haman, why do you have to wait until the end of the year when the edict goes into effect and you get to kill everybody? Why not just kill him now? I mean, you're a top dog. You can do this. You know, you're right. I do deserve this. It's about time that I just take care of Mordecai and I don't have to think about him anymore. Someone says, I got a great idea. If he wants to stand up and he doesn't want to bow down, let's raise him really high in the air. Let's hang him on a gallows that's 50 feet tall. Now, when they say gallows, we think the noose, you know, and the rope. But that wasn't an execution method that was common or even known of in that day. When they talk about a gallows, think more crucifixion. Or think pike, like a huge stake up in the air that they would kill the person and just hang their body up there for all to see. That's what they're suggesting here. And they're saying, if he wants to stand up, we'll put him up. Like we'll string this guy up so that everyone can see him and that everyone can see his greatness. And this is the perfect idea for Haman. And he had his bad mood. These advisors have calmed the bad mood. Things are good. He is able to sleep like a baby tonight because tomorrow, this is the one obstacle to his greatness is all gone. Well, while he's sleeping like a baby, the king is not. And the king decides, I don't know if it was just to put him to sleep or what, but the king decides, I'm going to have someone come and read me the royal records. So that sounds like an easy way to be put to sleep. Or maybe he's just so awake he decides to take care of administrative business. And it just so happens that they read the account of Mordecai saving him from the conspirators in the king's gate. And he asks, did we do anything for that guy? No, king, there's nothing on the records that we did anything for him. He thinks about it. Haman wakes up. He had a great night's sleep. He leaves his house. He turns back. He can see the pike standing up, towering above his house. Just the image of Mordecai hanging dead on that pike. This is a glorious morning for him. He knows Mordecai is going to be there in the gate and he's not going to bow. And that's going to be a little bit of a pain, but not today. Today, that's a small pain because I know what's going to happen to him later. He walks by all the people. They bow to him. Mordecai stands. He thinks, ha-ha, I'll let you stand later. And as he walks into the king's court, the king summons him. One of the envoys is there. Hey, Haman, the king wants you. Ah, yes, I know. I'm used to this by now. This is an everyday thing. The king just needs me. Hang on. He goes into the king. King says, listen, I've got a conundrum here. I need some help. What if there was someone I really wanted to honor, what would I do for them? Haman does a little bit of quick mental calculation. Let me see, who would this be? Well, there's no one greater in the kingdom than me, the guy who's invited to the banquet with the king and the queen, the guy who, you know, is second in command. This is for me. So what do I want? I'm going to do my Christmas list right now. So here's what I want. I want the king's horse. I want the king's clothes, his royal robe. I want the king, one of the king's crowns. And I'm going to have all that put on me. I'm going to have one of the king's nobles walk me around the city and saying, this is what we do to the man who the king honors. That's what I want. And so he says, king, this is what I would do. And he tells him. King says, you're such a good advisor. Go do this for Mordecai. He's a Jew. He sits in the king's gate. Imagine how crestfallen Haman must have been in that moment. Now, he cannot kill this guy. Like, he cannot walk him through the city. And then, hey, king, also, I've got this guy I want to kill. He's the guy you just honored this morning. No, this isn't going to happen. Mordecai is not going to die today. He might die later, but not today. And today, I've got to walk around the entire city hauling this horse with Mordecai lifted up above me. And I'm going to say, this is what should be done for the man who the king wants to honor. That's what I'm going to do. He is humiliated and mortified. He finishes up and he runs home and he weeps and bawls his eyes out to his family that he was just bragging to the night before. Oh, things are terrible. And the advisors even say, well, if that was Mordecai the Jew that you did that to, this is a really bad omen, buddy. We're even not going to give you advice. We're not going to try to cheer you up on this one. And in the middle of this pep talk, suddenly the king's messengers are there. Hey, time for the banquet. And he's carried off. So the king and Esther and Haman are sitting there. The king is itching to hear what his queen wants from him. Haman is just trying to forget the day that he just had. And it's working just a little bit because he's back where he wanted to be. He's back with the queen. He's back with the king. He's back in his position. And the king says, Esther, my queen, what do you want? She says, well, king, my people have been threatened with death and genocide. There's people who want to destroy every last one of us. And king, if what was happening was just that we were being sold into slavery or something along those lines, I wouldn't even be raising this to you. I'm raising this to you because we're in danger. And this is not only a danger to us, it's a danger to your kingdom. She's setting this up beautifully. King, I am threatened, right? She could have asked for anything up to the half the kingdom, and she is saying, listen, I just want my life. There are people threatening me and my people, and they are saying that I am going to die. And he says, who do I need to kill? That guy. She turns to Haman. Haman's mind begins moving very quickly at this point. Wait a second. Oh my goodness, she's a Jew. I have threatened to kill the queen. All of a sudden, Haman realizes that he is in a desperate position. The king is furious, so mad that he stands up and leaves and goes into the garden. And Haman, I don't know what's going through Haman's mind, but he's got one moment right now. This is the last moment that he can possibly save his life. He's got to do something. And he makes his move to the wrong person. Because imagine, had he gone to the king, listen, king, no, I'm not trying to kill your wife. I didn't even know she was a Jew. That's not it at all. But here's what's going on, and he could try to explain. Maybe he could have turned the tide, but he makes the move on the wrong person. And now when they're having a banquet together, we think of, you know, fancy tables and things like that. But this is the Middle East, and they are reclining on the floor. So they're laying there on the floor together, eating around a rug with the food on it. And he goes over to Esther and he gets down right on at her feet and is just begging her, please, queen, have mercy on me. And as he's there on top of her begging for his life, the king comes back in from the garden. And the king, who is already trying to figure out what's going on and who has already turned a little bit against Haman, he's not even looking for an excuse to kill him. He's looking for what do I do now? Here is Haman looking like he's assaulting his wife. Okay, get out of here. And the Bible says they cover his face. Like, this is a sign that was when you know you're gone, when your face gets covered. Like, it's just a matter of when and how. And there was someone there to suggest the how. Hey, king, guess what? Haman just set up this massive pike. It's hanging in the middle of town. And the king's like, perfect. Hang him on it now. And Haman's body he's killed and hung up on this pike for all to see. But that is not the end of the story. That's a beautiful cathartic end for us. But the people are still in danger. There is still a genocide that's going to happen. And so Esther goes before the king again, and the king's wrath, it says, is abated once he kills Haman. Well, that's not what she needs, because she didn't just want Haman to die. She wants the edict to be overturned. She wants her people to be saved. This has done nothing. From her perspective, that feels great to us because we love to see the bad guys get their dues. But from her perspective, things are still up in the air. Her life is still at risk. And so she talks to the king, and the king says, listen, here's my ring. Gives it to Mordecai. Go do what you can. And so Mordecai issues an edict that's exactly the same as the edict against the Jews. They could kill all of them and take their stuff. But he says, now the Jews can kill all of their enemies and take their stuff. So imagine being a leader in a province right now. Like, you've just got an issue, you know, a couple months ago saying all the Jews can be killed on this day, 11 months out. Okay, well, that's weird, but I mean, it comes from the king. And then you get another one. The Jews may kill all the people trying to kill them on that day. Okay, which do I follow? Like, which side is the king on? And why are we just allowing a civil war to happen in our lands right now? I mean, imagine how confusing that would be. And so Mordecai, moving like a slick operator, man, he does everything he can to indicate to the people that the king's preference is toward the second command. He sends everyone out on the royal horses. He comes out with flags and announces this decree in the name of the king. He really puts the king's energies behind this. And what happens in the end is that all the Jews on that day, they celebrate that they've got this opportunity to destroy their enemies. And on that day, when finally the day comes when they were supposed to be dying, they were able to fight for themselves and they kill their enemies. And then even again, like the day that all this happens in Shushan the palace, the king asks Esther, what do you want? Esther says, I want all of Haman's sons up on the pike. Poof, 10 sons up on the pike now, indicating that the king is on the side of the Jewish people. And then Mordecai is promoted. And if we go to chapter 10 and you see the very end, where all of this lands, where the story ends, King Ahasuerus lays a tribute on the land and upon the isles of the sea, and the acts of his power and his might, and the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him. Are they not all written in the chronicles of kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai, the Jew, was next unto King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of all the people, and speaking peace to all his seed. The story ends with the trifecta that was supposed to be there in the beginning. King, the great king, Esther, Mordecai, saving and working on the behalf of the Jewish people. That's what was supposed to happen in the beginning, and that's what happens in the end. A beautiful, wonderful story. But this story is in the Bible, so it's not just a story that we look at and enjoy, as enjoyable as it may be. This is the point in the sermon where we're supposed to say, okay, so here's what the script, what God has given us in his word. So what does it mean to us? What are we supposed to do with this? Now, you know, in the books of the Kings, you've got statements of things like, and he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, or you've got statements that say, this guy honored the Lord with everything except this. There's commentary say, this king turned away from the ways of his fathers, or there's some kind of commentary in there that kind of gives a moral evaluation of the story. But we don't get that in Esther. In fact, when you look through it, there's not really much moral commentary that's given. And when you begin to look at it even closer, you begin to realize that actually God doesn't show up at all in this story. And even in the way I've tried to tell it this morning, I've tried to tell it without any reference at all to God or Yahweh, the God of the Jews. Because the story that we have in the Bible, if you read through it, God doesn't show up. The people aren't praying. They don't go to worship him. There doesn't seem to be any reference to him at all. And so we have to ask the question then, okay, well, this is weird. We have a book in the Bible, a book that's supposed to be revealing God to us, that doesn't seem to mention God at all. We've got a book that is supposed to be inspired by the Spirit of God. It's supposed to be saying something that is both powerful for them and for us, and yet God doesn't even show up in it. So why would God inspire a book that doesn't even seem to say anything about him at all? Those are the questions that we have to answer. And as far as the question about the author goes, what is the human author that is doing this? What's his intent? Well, what we need to recognize is that this is incredibly intentional. Because if you look at where Mordecai is talking to Esther, he says, the people of Israel will be delivered. How can you be so confident? You're a person in the you're a small province in the middle of a massive empire, and the king has just issued an edict for you to die. That really is not a thing that you can be confident in. That's an open question. We might or might not live. But he says, we are going to live. Well, why is that? It's because he's a Jew. He knows the promises that have been given to his people. He has seen God send his people back to Jerusalem already. The temple has already been rebuilt after their captivity. Like, that's the station we're in, where Nehemiah is about to go back and rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. God is at work with his people. And so he knows this, and this is what's in his mind. So why did the author not include that he's following the promises of God? Again, we see Esther says, okay, let's fast. Well, what are they doing when they fast? Well, they're praying. They're asking God for grace and strength and help in this situation. But he doesn't say that they pray. He just leaves in the fasting. He deliberately, throughout the entire story, leaves out God, because the point of the book is to get us to ask that question. Wait a second, where is God? Why isn't he here? That's part of the artistic purpose of the book of Esther. And then when we back out and we say, okay, so then why would the Spirit want us to be asking this kind of question? Well, think about for just a second the situation that the Jews are in. They have been in captivity. They are still, in this case, in Shushan the palace of the Persian Empire. This is right after Daniel, after Daniel's kind of career in the royal court. And the people of Israel God is about to go silent for 400 years. The last word of the Old Testament is going to be written soon. Malachi is going to say what he has to say, and then silence. And it's going to be quiet. At the end of the book, we read, you'll have to read it on your own. They set up this festival that's supposed to celebrate this, and it's called the Festival of the Dice, the Festival of Purim. It's a celebration of the randomness of the dice. And it's going to happen every year, year after year after year. And this book is written to be read aloud to the people in that celebration, to remind them, why are we celebrating? Because of this story. And throughout these 400 years of quiet time, when God is not speaking, when the revelation of God is not coming through his prophets anymore, they are going to constantly be reminded of this story. And the question that that's going to be on their mind, and that was on their mind in the New Testament when Jesus starts to show up, is, where is God? Where are the promises that we have that God was going to save his people and bring us back? He was supposed to do something with us. He was supposed to send the new King David, who was going to take us away from captivity. Because now they're just a province of another empire. They don't have a king. They don't have their own unique government. They are underneath the Persians and then the Romans. They don't have that kind of freedom. And they're waiting for it. And the question on their minds is this very question: where is God? And that is the question that often haunts you and me, that we face times of difficulty, times where we feel like God is not speaking, times where we wonder what God is doing, why is this situation happening in my life? And we begin to ask questions like this: where is God in my circumstance? Where is God in the pain that I feel as a result of the struggles in my family life? Where is God when I'm facing physical illness and suffering? Where is God when it looks like the place he's supposed to be working here, Westside Baptist Church, and every church like it, the place he's supposed to be working, I just don't know that I see it. I feel like I don't see God. I want to see him. I want to see him in my life, but I just don't see him, and I wonder where he is. But the point of the book is not just to highlight that pain, not just to say, ha, I'm going to poke your pain and say, ha, you see, you can't even find God. This isn't some kind of book that's meant to just poke at that kind of reality. No, it's meant to give an answer, because when a faithful person reads this book, the answer of where is God is that he is everywhere. In fact, if you think of Proverbs chapter 16, I believe it is, verse number 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. That even the most random part of the story, what feels like the most random, is this man that's casting dice again and again and again and again to try to find the time when he thinks he should be doing this plot against the Jewish people. That is in the hands of God. And that's the most random part of it. And then you look at the coincidences of Esther being chosen out of all these girls from the empire. You look at the coincidence of, for some reason, Mordecai had her keep her personage hidden. Mordecai, for some reason, decides to not bow to this guy. And then this guy decides, instead of just taking out Mordecai, he's going to take out the entire Jewish people, and there's going to be this genocidal decree. And then it's in the end, though, it's all going to be turned around for the salvation of God's people. And not just that they were preserved, but that their enemies are defeated. God isn't just using this as an opportunity to save them from destruction. He actually uses it to advance their cause in the empire. And then they've got Mordecai at the king's side. This God is on every page of the book of Esther. God is there. But here's the thing. If they wanted to see God, they had to believe the promises that God had already made. If they wanted to see God, they had to trust that what God had said to them in the revelation through the prophets and through the law of Moses and through the stories of their kings and of their people, that they had to believe that God was going to keep his promises. So if this morning you're here and you want to see God, you're saying, I want to see God work, I want to see God in my life or in this circumstance or in this church, you have to open your ears. It's not a question of looking for him and trying to find and doing a detective scan. That's not us. We have to open our ears to the word that God has given us and what he has promised and what he has done, and by faith believe that. And that enables us to see God in the everyday movements of our life. It's not that we literally see him. It's that God opens our eyes in faith. Flip over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Look at verse number 3. And notice the imagery language, speaking of like seeing things. But if our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost. It's hid. It's out of sight. In whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds. Blinded, again, covered the eyes. The mind, blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light, what we see, of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. For we preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves your servants, for Jesus' sake. For God, who commanded the light to shine out of the darkness, hath shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. If you want to see the face of Jesus Christ, you know where you look for it? You don't look for it in the Shroud of Turin or some other historical depictions or an AI recreation of what Jesus would have looked like. You want to see Jesus with your eyes? Look at the gospel. Look at what he has revealed about himself. That's what allows us to see him. And when we do, we see that the book of Esther is not just the story of the people of the Jews, but it's our story. Because we too were a people that were aimed, targeted for destruction. Specifically, though, there was a man who was targeted for destruction, Jesus. The very image of God was threatened to be destroyed. He is on earth, and Satan wields all of his powers against him. We are going to destroy this man. Everyone knows this is the Messiah. This is the guy who's going to crush the enemy. This is our new Mordecai. This is the guy who not only is going to be second to the king, but he is going to take the king's place. The Roman Empire is going to be gone. Man, we're in good shape. God is at work. We see God now. I mean, look at these miracles. Look at this stuff that's happening. Oh, yeah, we see God for sure. Our eyes are opened. We're following him. We know that this is the man. And then there's a crucifixion that's being threatened. We know how this turns out. We've read the book of Esther. Watch this. I know who's going to end up on that pike. Caesar is going to be up there tomorrow. Just you wait. Then it keeps going. Then it keeps going. And this trial goes. And no, it's not looking good for Jesus. Turns out he ends up on the cross. And now all of the followers who said they saw so clearly what was going on, they're all in total disarray because, wait a second, the one who was supposed to be, you know, where's the big reversal here? Weren't we supposed to see the enemy thrown up on the pike instead of the king? Maybe he's not who he said he was. Maybe he's not the real Messiah. That's the question that's in their minds. But what they had to believe was what they could not see with the eyes of faith, that this was truly the Messiah. And what they couldn't see is that he was actually destroying the enemy just a very different way than they expected. There's a thing that my kids and I do on, my family and I do on Saturday nights. It's a thing we recite at mealtime Saturday nights. I say, what is the story of the Bible? And they say, kill the dragon, get the girl. And then I say, who is the dragon? And they say, our enemy Satan and the sin that smells like him. And then I say, and who's the girl? And they say, the church. And I say, and who is the dragon slayer? And they say, our Lord Jesus Christ. And then I say, how did he kill the dragon? By dying for the girl. That's the answer. And what the world doesn't know is that that death is what killed Satan. That is what defanged him. That is what dethroned him. There is no longer a power that is over us. And what looked counterintuitive to them, this man hanging up on the pike, that's what killed the powers of death. And then I ask them, is that the end of the story? And they say, no. I say, what happened on the first day of the week? And they say, Jesus rose from the grave. And so I say, do we fear death by dragon? No. And then we have a toast. Because we see not with the eyes of our flesh, we see with the eyes of faith, and we believe the gospel of Jesus. We believe what cannot be easily seen with our eyes. And this morning, I want to see God at Westside. I want to see God move in our midst. I want to see great things happen with this church. But the truth is, God is already at work here. God is already doing great things here. The question is not, is God doing something? The question is, are our eyes open to see what God is doing and what seems so mundane and so simple and so monotonous and boring sometimes? But what do we see? We see the grace of God when a child says thank you for a toy without being prompted. We see the grace of God when maybe a husband and wife who are at each other's throats regularly, one moment the husband holds back his tongue or the wife holds back that slight that she was going to give. And we see the grace of God at work. And over time, we see lives changed and moved in. But we have to have eyes that are opened, not by our imagination coming up with how God's going to work this all out, but rather by trusting that what God has said he's going to do, he is actually at work. If God has said he's going to work in my brother or my sister that is here, God is at work in them, and I can trust that. And I can look at my brothers and sisters with faith, knowing that God is moving you in a direction to be like Jesus. So this morning, if you want to see God in your life, if he feels hidden, if you don't know where he is, if you want to see God, open your ears.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.